You know that 1 Corinthians chapter 13 isn't great because of the flowery language that seems to be in it. In that chapter, of course, Paul talks about and describes love throughout the whole thing. And it's a beautiful chapter as far as that goes, but that's not what makes it great. It's something else that we need to get to the root of to understand and fully appreciate why this chapter exists. Why is it here? Is it just for the purpose of describing love in sentimental ways? That's the way it's often used. But is that it? I propose to you tonight, there's a whole lot more to it. There's a whole lot more to what makes this a great chapter of the Bible. I want to start tonight with an illustration. Now, Fred and Dave, you guys can't get too excited here. But I did bring toys tonight. Anybody know what this is? I can't go so far.
It's an EQ pedal.
It's an EQ pedal. It's for my guitar playing guys. Now, I knew that would happen. Sometimes all the lights work, sometimes all the lights don't work. If you ever had a stereo that had an EQ on it, you can just slide these little things here, and that'll give you some more low end, and this one over here will give you some more high end. And when you plug a guitar into this, you start doing something that guitar players call chasing tone.
Shoegazing.
Shoegazing and chasing tone. So every record that you've ever heard, every guitar player you've ever heard, either through some combination of guitars. See, I wasn't allowed to bring the guitars, so I had to bring the pedals. They'll use something like this to clean up their tone a little bit. Or I brought more tonight. They start adding pedals because I just can't find the tone. So you'll get a chorus pedal, or you'll get a delay pedal, or you'll get, bless you, or you'll get an echo delay pedal, or you'll get I don't know what this one is. Have no idea. This one's a screamer. That one's a tube screamer. That one's called Bacon and Eggs. Dan Electro. Some of them got really funny names. I got a new pedal today. That one's... All right, that's an inside joke if you don't know.
Creamy tone,
yeah. Banana tone. But, you know, you start tinkering around with all these things. And all of them have their own knobs and their own little gauges and levers and whatever. And eventually you come up with the perfect tone. Actually, the banana has no input, so you can't use it. So that's what you do. You're chasing the perfect tone. Now, what in the world does that have to do with 1 Corinthians chapter 13? Well, leave it to me to either figure it out or not. But we're constantly chasing tone as guitar players, and I want to suggest to you that as congregations of God's people, as individual Christians, but also as congregations of God's people, we're constantly chasing tone. You have to be careful with your adjustments. You don't want to adjust too much too soon. You want to be real careful about how you dial in the knobs. Every congregation of the church that has ever existed is chasing tone for God. And the letters of the New Testament that are written to churches and some few to individuals, most of them written to saints or collections of saints in a given area, They represent what God hears in our playback. We're all writing and crafting songs. And we're saying, let's try this pedal and let's try this amplifier and we'll try this drum head and we'll see how it sounds. And then God sort of lifts up under the hood and takes a listen to it and says, well, this is what I hear. And so throughout the New Testament, all of these letters, like 1 Corinthians, they're commendable actions, the things that God says, attaboy, those are things we can learn from. We want to repeat that stuff. We want to use that pedal, dialed in that way. But there's other places in these letters where God says, not so much of that. You need to back that off. You need to unplug that one entirely. Now, 1 Corinthians stands out to us because God simply says, actually, we're going to throw the whole studio out because you guys are a mess. I don't want to be too hard on the Corinthian church. They get a lot of flack. It's not unearned. There's a lot of adjustments that need to be made. There's not so many good things that are said. It's a lot of God saying, I don't like what I'm hearing. Consider the problems of the Corinthian church. The first three chapters are dedicated to divisions among them. Cliques. A party spirit, sometimes people used to say. Little factions, little groups, little cliques, little divisions. And what are they dividing over? Favorite preachers, favorite apostles, and who knows what else? I was baptized by this one and I was baptized by that one. I mean, it almost sounds like grade school, doesn't it? Chapter 4, these people are challenging the apostleship of Paul. Paul feels the need to defend himself and defend his apostleship. And it's not that there wasn't anything to say. Paul even admits in chapter 15, I was born out of due season. I'll give you that. Paul didn't take part in the ministry from the beginning, as was required of someone like Matthias, who was chosen to replace Judas. We just saw that in Acts 1 and Acts 2. Paul wasn't there. He wasn't there from the beginning of John's ministry down to the beginning of Jesus' ministry and bore witness to the ministry of Christ. Now, I suggest to you that he bore witness to the ministry of Christ, especially probably this is an assertion. I can't prove it, but when he was in Arabia for several years, probably being trained by the Lord in the way that he had trained his other disciples, or in some sense being trained by the Lord as an apostle. But they're challenging of Paul's apostleship. In chapter 5, Paul deals with an issue of sexual immorality, which he said would make the pagans blush. That a man would have his father's wife. Stepmother, we presume. Chapter 6, they're taking one another to court to settle their issues. Chapter 7, they had questions about marriage and remarriage and such things as that. Chapter 8, Paul deals with them eating food sacrificed to idols, or not eating food sacrificed to idols, and quibbling over that. Chapters 9 and 10, Paul deals with idolatry, which is, in this instance, putting some personal preference over the good of your brother or sister in Christ. Chapter 11, he deals with whether or not the women should be wearing head coverings in the environment in which they find themselves. And then in chapter 11, also their abuse of the Lord's Supper. They actually are using the Lord's Supper. Now, they wouldn't have said it this way, but they're using the Lord's Supper to basically beat each other over the head with. Some are participating and they're leaving others out. Some are allowed to be a part of it and some aren't. I mean, can you imagine something like that? Can you imagine us coming in here and having that type of situation? In chapters 12 through 14, which conveniently is where chapter 13 is sandwiched right in the middle, Paul deals with their abuse of the miraculous gifts of the Spirit. Leave it to the Corinthian church, who would make pagans blush with their morality, to also take something as divine as the miracles, the first century miracles, and find a way to abuse that as well. And to, you know, find ways to divide over it. And so 12 and 13 and 14 deal with the abuse of miraculous gifts, and then the duration of the miraculous gifts, more or less, that's to cut it sort of short, and the regulation of those gifts, the proper practice of those gifts as they gather together. Then chapter 15 is the great resurrection chapter, and you say, well, I don't think there's anything in there worth saying too much about, but if you turn to chapter 15 and verse 12, where Paul makes this big, huge argument about the resurrection of Christ. Now, if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how come some of you say there is no resurrection from the dead? That's crazy. These are Christians who we know what Paul has written in Romans chapter 10, that if you confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, and that God has raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. And if you confess with your heart, or you confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. I mean, that's fundamental to being a Christian. And Paul says, how is it that some of you are saying that Christ wasn't raised? Then we're down to chapter 16, where he deals with the collection for the needy saints in the church. And then, of course, the conclusion, concluding part of that letter. They had a lot of tweaks to be made. How do you get a church like that to change? How do you get a church like that to get a better tone? Carefully. Patiently. Incrementally. Lovingly. But are they that different from us? Are they really that different? I mean, I'd like to think at least in some of the particulars, maybe we don't have those problems. But are they that different? A number of years ago, and it wasn't here, I forget, it was in Jolly Seniors, I think, this week, somebody said that I said that about something else. It wasn't here. It was over yonder. But I had an idea, and it never manifested, but I did work on it for quite a while, and I still have the documents that I was working on then. I never finished it, never came to fruition, but I had the notion of doing a doctrinal survey from the congregation. Now, the reasons for this were many, but let me tell you that in doing so, it was going to be completely anonymous, except for a couple of metrics. I wanted to know if you were male or female, and I wanted to know what age bracket you were in. And so that would start at 20 and go to 29, 30 to 39, so on and so on. And those would be the only sort of parameters that you would get as far as that would go. Now, interestingly, when you sit down and do something like that, you realize just how much, quote, doctrine there is. It's a lot. You know, you get into the hundreds of questions and you're like, people are not going to do this. That was part of the thing. The other part of it was I did it sort of late in my tenure at my other work, and so it never panned out. And but I've thought about it. I've thought about it a lot since. I kind of wish I knew what the research would show, because I always had this suspicion. And let me tell you, the motivation behind it was simply to get the pulse. What should we be preaching? What should we be teaching? What should we be focusing on? Are there any problem areas? Things like that. I think that's good. I don't think that's a bad thing. I know that people sometimes get a little, you know, edgy about stuff like that, and they're not interested in doing that sort of thing, and that's fine too. It would be completely voluntary. But the more information you have, I feel like the better you can serve people and know what maybe you need to teach or what you need to touch on or where we have weak spots or something like that. I don't think it's a bad thing. But as I said, it never really came out, but we never finished it, so we never did the survey. But I was wondering then, and I still wonder to this day, and I wonder to this day here as well, how different some of our views on certain things might be. When I first started preaching, and this is completely innocent on my part, I just, you know, you don't know what you don't know. You're just, you know, I am what I am as it is, but I was a lot dumber. I was a lot dumber back then. But I had this kooky idea that everything that I had been taught growing up that turned out to be true And everything that I had learned to be true up until the time I was 25, 26, 27 years old, that everybody in the church believed that stuff. But now I've been at this long enough. I mean, full time I've been at this since 2004. I've been preaching since November of 2000. It's 25 years of doing this, and 20 of it full time. And I've come to realize that people are different. People are different. People have different ideas. They have different opinions about things that we have different opinions about. And I'd like to think all of us believe what we confessed before we were immersed for the remission of our sins, which is that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, with the implication that He was raised from the dead. But here were some Corinthian Christians who, for whatever reason, have gotten the notion after they were converted that maybe Jesus wasn't raised from the dead. And I think, are they that different from us? I wonder what people are thinking. You can't assume. And I think if we did a survey like that, we might be surprised to see what some of the answers were. Maybe we wouldn't want to know what some of the answers were. But people are different. But it's not just that people are different. It's also that every person in their race, in their Christian race, is some distance from Christ. You know, you take this little pedal here that I was showing you a moment ago, and I wish all those would light up. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, I'm sure somebody could fix it. But you know, some people are way down here, and some people are way up here, and some people are in between. Everybody's in a different place in their relationship with Christ. I mean, when you came out of the grave of baptism, when you came up out of that, you could have sat down and wrote your whole perfect systematic theology, right? And you now adhere to everything in exactly the same way and say, man, you understand it exactly the same way you did then, right? Nothing's changed. You haven't learned more or grown at all. We're all learning, and they were too. I wrote in the bulletin, and I suppose some of you may have read it. You know, you think about the Corinthian church, and they were made up of so many different kinds of people. And part of that was because of the background of Corinth. Corinth was a very young city at the time that Paul went there and when this letter was written. 20, 30 years maybe. Corinth had been devastated by the Romans in 146 BC. And Julius Caesar formed it into a city again, made it a colony, a Roman colony again, 44 AD. And so by the time Paul gets there, Corinth barely exists. There's about maybe 20,000 colonists living there, and some of them are Christians. And Corinth was the type of place that was, you know, I don't want to call it a melting pot. It really wasn't a melting pot, but Corinth was a seaport, and there was just people from all over the world, from all different backgrounds and cultures. Give them some credit. Give this congregation some credit that they didn't deny anybody the gospel. These people ran the gamut of all different kinds of beliefs and ideals and backgrounds. So they weren't discriminating about who they shared the gospel with. And I hope that we're not either. But what happens as a result of that, when you share the gospel with anybody and everybody, when you open that up to everybody, what does that mean? Well, you're going to get all kinds. I mean, Jesus taught the parables as he did, the parable of the dragnet as he did. I mean, you're going to catch a little bit of everything. And everybody's going to have a different background and a different idea, different theological ideas based on where they come from. I know right here among us that there are some people that come into their relationship with Christ and never had any relationship with any religion whatsoever. Sometimes that clean start is easier than to have a religious background. Some of you sitting here have had a false religious background and upbringing. And you came to the knowledge of the truth and you had a light bulb moment. And you said, whoa, wait a minute. Something about this isn't right. I have to find the truth. And some of us were raised up, quote, in the church. Some of us were raised up, quote, in the denomination. Some of us were raised up, quote, outside of the church. It was just a little bit of everything. So we're all going to, everything's going to be identical. We're going to be different. Maybe not as different as the church at Corinth. So I suppose tonight, maybe because we're dealing with great chapters and it's kind of the way I've been doing it, you'd like a neat exposition of this great chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, but I'm not going to do that. Because I feel like if I do that, at least for the purposes of this lesson, we'll miss what makes it great. 1 Corinthians 13 was called into being because of one of the greatest problems the church ever had or will ever have. You think it's some moral issue or, you know, something like that, some doctrinal issue. But if you really stop and think about this, this could have been an absolute disaster. And it was becoming an absolute disaster. And that was the presence of miracles in their midst. Now, isn't that something to consider? Miracles. I mean, you and I would probably think as outside observers, well, if we could do the miracles that they could do in the first century, can you just imagine? This, by the way, is the pitch of the worldly church. This is the pitch of the worldly church. The worldly church is, you know, God is this ramped up, sort of get excited about secular concert idea that everybody gets stirred up in this great big frenzy and there's just miracles going on and it's all this just flurry of craziness. That's what the worldly church is. That's what the worldly church sells. It sells a feeling. I was watching something last week. I don't want to go too deep on this tangent. God knows I'll get lost. But I was watching something actually from a church over yonder. It just happened to come up on YouTube one morning. I was like, well, that's interesting. What's going on here? And it was church down yonder, back close to where we used to live. And I was like, well, what is going on here? I'll listen to it for a little bit and see what it's all about. And they're having this big revival, and that's fine. And I'm listening to the preacher, and he's saying, This isn't about a feeling. It's not about a feeling what's happening right here. It's not about a feeling. This is about God. It's not about a feeling. This is more than a feeling. It's not about it. He kept repeating it over and over and over again. And I thought, you know what? I would bet if I was a betting man, and I'm not, but if I was a betting man, somebody's going to get up here and tell them that they have to feel it. I just know it's coming. I can feel it coming. And I don't mean to be critical. And again, Lord knows I can be criticized and ought to be. But I'm listening to this. It's not about a feeling thing. And I'm just thinking, I know it's coming. Next guy gets up and he goes, well, you know, I felt it in my heart. And I felt it and felt it and felt it and so on. And everybody's getting up and giving these testimonies. I felt it and I felt it and felt it. And I thought, well, there it went, out the window. So much for truth. Does it feel good to be a Christian or no? Yes. Does it feel good to be part of the family of God? Yes. Are we excited to be Christians? Yes. Okay. We don't have to climb pews to get that point across, but we're excited. Okay. But I get concerned when I go to a secular concert of my favorite band, and that's an environment, right? That's a place. Not everybody wants to go to that place, but it's our favorite band and we enjoy it. You know, we enjoy going together and just get lost in music for a little bit and just enjoying that. But that's not worship. That's not worship. And I don't want that. I don't want that. You see, that's a give and take manipulation of the relationship. I know that is. I bought that. I'm going to give you something and you're going to give me something. It's a transaction. And so I want you to give me everything you got and I'll give you everything I got in that way, right? And we're going to work each other up into a frenzy over it. But what we're dealing with the Lord, when we're worshiping the Lord, we're not feelings first. We don't leave our brain at the door. And what's being sold is this idea that if you feel it, once you feel it, you'll know the Lord is here. So it's the same old stuff, but it's being packaged up in new ways. And in Corinth here, they had these miracles, and you would think, well, this would be a great thing. But look what has happened. Instead, it's turned into a performance. And so if we use 1 Corinthians 13 the way it's most often used, from the perspective that Paul is just being poetic about love, about marital love, and so we've got something to recite at a wedding. And by the way, absolutely nothing wrong with reciting it at a wedding. I'm just saying that's not why it was written. I hope we know that, because otherwise we've missed the point. The Corinthian church had gotten into their minds the same thing that a lot of people still have in their minds today, which is that the miracles were an end in and of itself. They had gotten into their mind the same thing that many people today still have in their heads, which is that the miracles are still the greatest possible thing. They're what make the church go. And they're what binds the church together. And when you believe that, the miracles and the stirring up of the emotions and all that stuff, that's the proof of God's power and presence. Oh, I can feel it. God is here tonight. I've heard a lot of stuff blamed on God before. Or on a spirit that I'm not sure is holy. That would then be proof of God's power and presence. It's proof that your faith is genuine because you felt it. And by the way, you may have been in this position or you may have known of someone who has been in this position, but once you get somebody to feel something and you help them identify that as their salvation and their relationship with God, you try wrestling that out of their hands. I've known personally and heard other stories of people saying, I wouldn't change the feeling that I have right here for a whole stack of Bibles. In other words, I don't care what the Word of God says. I know what I feel. The problem, of course, as I hope we all know, is that our sincerity can be completely misguided. And feelings are easily manipulated. People are easily manipulated by emotions and feelings. But it's the proof. God's power is here. God's presence is here. Your faith is genuine. It's proof that you're going to heaven. That's how my wife was raised. The miracle proves you're sealed and on your way to heaven. Well, if somebody tells you, if you don't have a miraculous experience, you can't go to heaven, what are you going to do? I think you're going to find a way to have a miraculous experience. Or you're going to seek to identify an experience with the miraculous. So when people are taught and believe that miracles are proof of God's power and presence, that they prove that your faith is genuine, that you're going to heaven, all of a sudden the miracles are everywhere and it's all about the miracles. And the miracles couldn't have possibly ceased. They call it cessationist. You're a cessationist. You believe the miracles have ceased? What, you're stripping God of His power? You're stripping God of His glory? Are you saying that God can't work? That God doesn't perform miracles anymore? Or that God can't perform miracles anymore? Well, God can do anything He wants to do. It's not a matter of whether or not God has the power. It's whether or not the miracles were ever that great in the first place for the church. Now, they had a purpose. But they weren't an end in and of themselves, and they became problematic. And people say, well, I don't understand that. Well, tell me that the miracles of Jesus just converted everybody. Did they? No. Did they keep him from being killed? No. When Jesus was raised from the dead, did all the disciples believe then? No. Why wasn't the whole world just instantly converted? Oh, here's the walking dead. Miracles ain't everything. Not that kind. And what about the first century church? Were they needed? They were needed, yes, because there were people who were sincere of heart, who didn't have a New Testament text like you and I have, who needed the words of the apostles confirmed by miraculous signs. And when they got the miraculous signs, they said, oh, these guys are telling the truth. But if that truth has been revealed once for all, as Jude says, then the need, the biblical need for the miracles, according to Mark 16, 9 through 20, no longer exists. There's the miracle. I don't know what that was, but there's the miracle. There's the miracle. I probably don't need it. I don't know. Oh, that's songs. The 1 Corinthians 13 was written to let the church at Corinth know that all their division and their dissension, which even spilled over into how they were using the divine blessing of spiritual gifts, would one day prove to be would prove to be shoddy craftsmanship in building the church. If they're building the church on the wow factor and who had it and who didn't, they weren't going to make it. That's not the principle that held the church together. The principle that holds the church together at its core is truth. But beyond that, as relates to one another, the thing that holds us together, the miracle that holds people together from all varied backgrounds, from around the world, and gets us focused on the same person, and gets us to forget about ourselves and be concerned about the other, that gets us to sacrifice ourselves for the benefit of the other. That is love. It's love. Herein is love, John wrote, not that we loved God, but that He loved us. A new commandment, Jesus said, I give to you, that you love one another. Not out-miracle each other. Not wow everybody with the wave of a wand. The new commandment is that you love one another. As I have loved you, so you love one another. There's the power. There's your miracle. People that shouldn't love each other, that shouldn't have anything to do with each other, that shouldn't even know each other, love each other, and lay down their lives for each other. Now that is an act of God. There's a miracle for you. There's some potent glue holding people together who are held by Christ. Miracles can't do it. They can do it a little bit when they're most needed. And then as they linger on in the church in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, they become a problem. You know what never becomes a problem? Love. Never. You know the old songs that people sing that love hurts. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Sin hurts. Betrayal hurts. Love never hurts. Did you read 1 Corinthians 13? You say, yeah, but I love somebody and they didn't love me back or whatever. That wasn't love then. Wasn't love on their part. Maybe it was love on your part, not on theirs. Yeah, but don't relationships dissolve? Somebody didn't love. Period. The church cannot and will not be held together by performance. Miracles were from God, yes, but they turned into performance and it ripped them apart. So Paul, the sound engineer, steps in and says, we got to adjust the knobs. Got out his EQ pedal. Wrong sound. Wrong tone. We got to fix it. In 1 Corinthians 13, is Paul going full bore with all the knobs and all the switches all the way up on love. The church has been built and will continue to stand only on something that cannot be abused or used to abuse others, loving one another as God loved us. That is not only the only thing that can endure, it is the only thing that will endure. Now we read it to conclude. If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. If I give away all that I have, if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I don't have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love never envies or boasts. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices
with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Prophecies, they'll pass away. Tongues, they'll cease. Knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. You know, Paul is saying it's like a married couple that they put the focus all on the kids. Focus on your kids. You got to focus on your kids. Take care of your kids, no doubt. But you know the story I'm about to tell, don't you? Of the couples that spend 25 years raising their kids, but they don't spend any time with each other. And then the kids move out, and they don't know each other. Paul says, what's going to happen when the partial passes away, Corinth? What's going to happen when the miracles are gone that you think are so important, that you're willing to divide and bicker with each other over? What are you going to have left? If you don't have love, what good will it have served? You won't have anything, and the church will crumble. And that goes for anything that we put before love, yes? Then he illustrates, when I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. He's talking about, he's using himself as the analogy to the infant church, yes? So just like when I was a child, I spoke and thought like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish things. For now we, them, not you and me, them in that context, we see in a mirror dimly. We're getting revelation from God, bits and pieces. It's being written as he speaks. But then, face to face, just as clear as looking in a mirror. Now I know in part. Then shall I know fully, even as I have been fully known. That's not heaven, that's revelation. It may be true of heaven, but he's not talking about heaven. So now, faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest is love. In the grand scheme, the message of the Bible is that without God, you can adjust these pedals all you want. The tone's always going to stink. Won't be right. You need God. You need God's help. You need forgiveness. You need grounded in Christ. You need reprioritizing your life so that you can be beautiful to God and make beautiful music for Him. And if you're a child of God, perhaps there are some dials that need to be tweaked a little bit in your life, some things that need to be changed. And only you would know that, but it's between you and God. But if there's anything that we can do to help or encourage you, we hope you'll let us know as we stand.
There is a fire.